Recently, a woman named Taylor Swift played a 3-hour concert to over 288,000 people over 3 consecutive nights at the Melbourne Cricket Ground. A week later, over 300,000 audience members saw her in Sydney. It was the hottest ticket of the year, with the recent major Australian festival cancellations often being blamed on the fact that everyone blew their live music money on the Eras Tour. I was one of the millions of people who did not manage to get tickets, but everyone I know who was lucky enough to go had nothing but amazing things to say. I had friends who said it was the greatest night of their life. My cousin proposed to his girlfriend during Love Story. And so many commented on the atmosphere being positive, warm, and loving. Another astute friend pointed out this could be because the audience was predominantly female. Craft stores have run low on beads for months due to Swifties making friendship bracelets. The recent Super Bowl became the most watched event since the moon landing, undoubtedly due to her attendance and connection to it all. On the day of her recent album announcement, I witnessed grown women yell across my staff room to ask who had heard the news, and teenage girls run to each other screaming and hugging. Love her, hate her, or feel completely indifferent, there is no denying that Taylor Swift is a figure of significance. She was 2023's Time Magazine Person of the Year. Her current megastar moment is the culmination of 20 years of artistic development and growth of both her brand and her business. The demographic of her fans ranges. It's estimated that about half the population of Australia tried to buy tickets to her concert. But it's undeniable that her appeal is largely female and often young. The teenage girls I teach that love her, they really, really love her. They follow her every move. They look for clues in her videos. They grieve and celebrate with the breakups and couplings. It's amazing and powerful and honestly, a little scary sometimes. And then you have millennial women like me who feel like we've grown up with her. I was born in 88 and so have followed her career and relationships sometimes alongside my own. As her perspective on love and life has changed, I feel like mine has in a similar rhythm. This sometimes translates to a weird feeling of protectiveness of her music, particularly when it comes to young fans. When I see teenagers saying a song like "You're Losing Me" means a lot to them, I almost feel miffed, like they couldn't possibly understand or connect with a song about the breakdown of a long-term relationship. You don't understand, Gen Z, that song belongs to me. But that's part of it all, isn't it? Swift's music has a way of feeling both universal and deeply personal at the same time. It's why so many people feel a connection with it. With her. With other Swifties. When I knew I wasn't going to get to the concert, I bought tickets to a screening of the film, and while watching it, I was struck by how radical and empowering it felt to see a woman so unabashedly showing that it was okay to show vulnerability, to show herself feeling things. I've thought about it a lot since then. So, as you can probably tell by now, this month's episode is about Taylor Swift. I'm going to talk through her background, her biography, how she came to be where she is now, but also to share my thoughts about what it is about her that connects to young women so much. And what does her work say about the coming of age process? What can we see about growing up through the course of her career? Now, I am not a Taylor Swift scholar. There'll be things that I miss, things I simply won't have time to cover in depth, but here is my Taylor Swift episode. And I know it's been a long time coming. This was originally intended to be my February episode, but my involvement with the Adelaide Fringe made that an impossible task. And I'm only really just getting this under the wire for March. It's still March somewhere, I promise. I'm so sorry. We're getting back into the rhythm of doing this regularly. We will get there. Thank you for your understanding and your patience. And if you enjoy coming of age stories and would like to support the show, you can sign up to my Patreon at patreon.com/wildanddarling. There is also a link in the description. You get a bonus episode alongside every regular episode, like my extended interview with Tom Christopherson or my audiobook of A Christmas Carol I released in December. This month, I'm talking to my partner, Thomas Lambell. He's been a DJ for 20 years, really knowledgeable about music and music production, and has started learning piano for the very first time in his 30s. We talk about his formative music experiences, the experience of learning an instrument as an adult as opposed to a kid, and his thoughts on Taylor Swift. He's not a fan, spoiler alert, but I've brought him around a little bit. Other ways to support the show include following me on Facebook and or Instagram at Coming of Age Cast, to share the show with other people who might like it, and give it 5 stars on the podcast catcher of your choosing if it has that feature. That helps more people find it. Anyway, enough of that business. Let's get into it, shall we? Taylor Allison Swift was born December 13, 1989 in West Reading, Pennsylvania. She is the eldest child of Scott and Andrea, who both worked in the finance sector. Her younger brother Austin was born in 1992. Her maternal grandmother was Marjorie Finlay, an opera singer and television personality. I am always interested in how someone starts on the road to superstardom at a young age, and it usually requires parental support and involvement. Sometimes this is to a toxic, unhealthy, and even exploitative degree. The Swifts, however, have yet to have that story told about them. Instead, it appears evident throughout Taylor's childhood, based on what we know so far, that they had the means and interest to let her pursue what she wanted to do. Musical theatre seems to be the first thing that sparked something in her, performing in many productions as a kid, and then travelling to New York City for voice and acting lessons from the age of around 9. She was often performing in local festivals and stage shows on the weekends. She cited Shania Twain and Faith Hill as her inspirations for becoming interested in country music. She was 12 when she learned the guitar and started writing her own music. And then, basically, a lot seemed to happen all at once. She met with record labels, though received rejections early on. She became an Abercrombie & Fitch model. She performed at coffee shops. Then when she was 14, the whole family relocated to Tennessee to help her pursue her career in country music. Take a moment to think about that. She was signed with Sony/ATV, becoming the youngest artist on their catalogue, though she left them soon after. During this period, she was finishing high school, from which she graduated a year early, playing small live gigs and showcases, and songwriting with other working songwriters such as Liz Rose, who she'd continued to work with for several years. She was playing at a showcase when a DreamWorks executive named Nathan Bechetta noticed her. He was planning to start a new label, Big Machine Records, and from there she became one of their first signings. Her father also bought into the company, and with producer Nathan Chapman, she released her first single, Tim McGraw, in June 2006. While it only reached number 40 on the Billboard charts, it made it to number 6 on the country charts, and when her self-titled album released in October 2006, it peaked at number 5 on Billboard. I've read conflicting reports for how long it stayed on the charts, but it was several years. It was a pretty big hit, leading her to tour around the US with other huge country artists like Rascal Flatts and Faith Hill. The album also won her a bunch of awards, as well as her first Grammy nomination for Best New Artist. It was all off and running, and would pretty much only get bigger from here. In 2008, we got her second album, Fearless, and here is where she exploded. The album went straight to number one, where it stayed for 11 weeks. In the US, it was 2009's best-selling album, and the awards and accolades kept coming, from Album of the Year at the Grammys and Artist of the Year from multiple institutions. She was also lauded at the MTV Music Video Awards, and here we get a key event in the timeline. As even non-Taylor fans know, Kanye West infamously interrupted her acceptance speech. There had already been interest in Taylor as a person, with a public relationship with Joe Jonas already under her belt, but I believe this moment is incredibly significant for her persona, the lore, the brand. There would be highly publicized fallout from the incident, the multitude of ways you could position her in relation to what happened, the memification from the moment. It was a key part of the transition of Taylor Swift going from singer to a personality. To a star. Speak Now, the first album she wrote in its entirety, was released in October 2010 and sold over 1 million copies in its first week. Red followed in October 2012, debuting at number one, and the single We Are Never Getting Back Together becoming her first ever number one hit on the Billboard charts. Meanwhile, she's also writing tracks for and with other artists, selling out huge tours, and recording songs for movie soundtracks. The awards continue to come. Her relationships become the subject of more scrutiny, and her lyrics are analysed intensely to figure out who they could be referring to. It's worth noting that Swift does not have a personal life section on her Wikipedia, which often contains the details of celebrities' relationships. In her case, her high-profile boyfriends are listed right alongside her career trajectory, as they do often seem embedded into it. This is the era of Jake Gyllenhaal, Connor Kennedy, Harry Styles. Her status as a girlfriend seems to be alongside her status as a pop star. This is the time when she appears on Ellen, who makes a game out of guessing which male celebrities Taylor has dated. She repeatedly says in the interview that she's uncomfortable, but Ellen ploughs on through. This clip has resurfaced recently, particularly in light of other allegations about Ellen's general conduct throughout her show, and people have been quick to point out how flipping toxic this is. But at the time, these sort of comments about Swift were common. I remember hearing jokes about how often her songs were about breakups, suggesting her next album should be called something like Maybe It's Me, which is funnier in retrospect considering the lyrics of Antihero. She's always been somewhat private about her personal life, but the raw emotional honesty in her songs, as well as her numerous famous partners, mean the speculation about her life and loves has become one of her biggest assets, as well as making her a target. In March 2014, Swift moves to New York and begins her collaboration with producer Jack Antonoff. She releases 1989, her first real pop album, though Red was starting to show signs of that style. 1989, it's a huge hit, unsurprisingly. But this period is also marked by some other pretty big milestones. For example, she openly protests her music being streamed on Spotify and the tiny residuals that artists get, taking down her entire catalogue, and she also speaks out about artists not receiving royalties during Apple Music's trial period. This eventually leads to Apple Music changing that policy. Kanye West releases the song Famous with the line, "I made that bitch famous," referring to Swift. She denies she gave consent for the line. Kim Kardashian releases a voice recording that seems to claim she did. And there's a backlash about Swift seemingly trying to control her narrative too much. She's called a snake openly for the first time. She's in a short-lived but media-loved relationship with Tom Hiddleston before getting into a long-term relationship with Joe Alwyn. She also becomes the centre of a highly publicised legal battle after she claims radio DJ David Mueller groped her during an event. He sues her for defamation, she countersues, and wins. All of this stuff combines into this intense mess of support for her and backlash. And then in November 2017, she releases the album Reputation, which features more adult-themed content and seemingly addresses a number of the relationships, controversies, and media storms she's been a part of in the longest gap she's had between albums yet. This album and all of the business surrounding it is another sort of turning point. I know there was some initial disappointment from the album as it was such a departure from her style. And speaking personally, I was really hoping for more of a punk album. There was also a little bit of doubt about just how self-aware Taylor Swift was amongst increased criticism of, well, almost every part of her public persona. The album was also released in the fallout of the 2016 election, and many people called it tone-deaf, particularly as Taylor had never been one to weigh in on politics or use her platform to speak up on behalf of many issues other than, say, during the sexual assault case, which did have her put in the 2017's Time Person of the Year, which they called the Silence Breakers, those who had spoken up about sexual harassment and violence against women. It's all a bit of a mess in some ways, right? At the time, British GQ called her a lightning rod for accelerating cultural anxieties about race, gender, and privilege. In a lot of ways, it was all becoming less about her and more about what she represented, and that was wildly different things to different people. Relationship was touted as both a comeback and a downfall. The awards and chart topping didn't stop, though. It was a smash everywhere, and after her sweep at the 2018 American Music Awards, she became the most awarded female musician. In November 2018, she signed a new deal with the Universal Music Group on the provision that she would maintain ownership over all her recordings. See, her former label, which owned the masters of all her previous work, was then sold to Scooter Braun, a deal Taylor Swift publicly criticised. She tried to buy her albums back, to no avail. Her first album under her new deal was Lover, released in August 2019. And we are back to the top of the charts. It's the highest selling album in America in 2019 and was absolutely embraced as a return to form for those who were not so thrilled with Reputation and also just looking at the continued growth of herself as an artist. This is also the year she appeared in the film version of Cats. Now, I've largely not discussed her film appearances in this overview because they really often feel like more of a side note, but I cannot not mention Cats. I could talk about this film just for hours on its own, but here it's just worth noting that something so disastrous for all involved, she came out kind of unscathed, and her original song for it is pretty damn good. And then we get to 2020. The documentary Miss Americana is released on Netflix, chronicling her career up until this point, and really claiming this as a time when Swift is escaping the expectations, pressure, and restrictions of her past, and taking control and agency over her career, her image, her work, and her voice. This idea is supported by her beginning the process of re-recording her old albums so that there are copies that she owns. With little to no publicity, she releases the album Folklore, an absolute sensation that highlights not only her songwriting but her growing maturity. It is unequivocally an album with an adult voice, as is its follow-up Evermore just a few months later. You've noticed I've stopped listing all the stats and the awards because, well, we just know they're there, right? Every album is the same story. This is the year she becomes the highest paid musician in the US and becomes the first woman to win Album of the Year 3 times at the Grammys. Then in 2021, we get her Taylor's versions of Fearless and Red, which do stupidly well. And she also includes Vault tracks, previously unreleased songs by her, and damn, they're a treasure for her fans. October 2022 sees the release of Midnights, another absolute smash hit album. In 2023, her version of Speak Now in 1989 come out, and she becomes the woman with the most number one albums on the Billboard charts, bumping Queen Barbra Streisand from that record. And of course, she embarks on the Eras Tour, the 3-hour extravaganza of a concert that inspires friendship bracelet making, memes, outfits, and so much online content. In her personal life, her 6-year relationship with Joe Alwyn comes to an end. She has a weird something with Matty Healy and eventually becomes committed to football player Travis Kelce, boosting both of their profiles even further. She ends 2023 by being the most streamed artist on Spotify for that year, Time Magazine's Person of the Year, the Eras Tour being the highest grossing tour in history, cracking $1 billion. For someone who's basically been famous since she started, she entered a whole new realm in 2023. And at the start of this year, she's announced her 11th studio album will be released in April and titled The Tortured Poets Department. As I said in the intro, on the day of that announcement, I walked through the yard at the high school where I teach and saw the news break in real time, with teenage girls running up to each other, screaming, hugging, even crying with each other. It was kind of amazing to see, especially when you compared that with the fact that when I went into the staff room, several of the fully grown adult women were not having a dissimilar reaction. I was literally greeted with, "Oh my God, have you heard?" And so, that pretty much brings us up to date. I know I've missed some things, some details, some accolades, but I think that gives you an overview of Taylor Swift's career up until this point without, you know, getting too weird about it, I hope. So, what does any of this have to do with coming of age or growing up or childhood or any of, you know, the themes of this podcast? I actually think a lot of things, and I'm going to do my best to organize my thoughts in a way that is coherent. First of all, let's look at the trajectory of Taylor's career and evolution as both an artist and a public figure. She was a literal child when she first picked up a guitar, and only a young teenager when she started actively pursuing her career as a singer-songwriter. Her first album is released a month before her 17th birthday. She is now 34. She has been in the public eye longer than she hasn't been. We have seen her grow up right before us as a person, as a woman, and as an artist. This can be seen in so many ways, but I think the most obvious one is in her songwriting. Her early albums are exemplified by first loves, heartbreaks, the giddy ecstasy of new experiences, and also the weird kind of early nostalgia you get when you're only a teenager. I think about the song The Best Day, reflecting on her relationship with her parents, particularly her mum, written when she was only 18 or 19. As time goes on, the themes and tones of her songs become more nuanced as her understanding of relationships and life in general grows. Early songs rage against cheating. There are a number of tracks dedicated to talking about how she's different than the popular girls and talking about stealing men, or let's be real, boys, away from their less deserving counterparts. By the time we get to the album 1989, there is none of that, and instead we find a more supportive and understanding perspective. Fidelity, or the lack thereof, isn't seen as a simplistic deal-breaker, with whole numbers dedicated to the complexities of love and commitment. Even something as small as the fact that she starts to swear, talk about sex, drinking, clubbing, indicate her growing up. This is also indicative of her having more control over her output and finding a more authentic voice for herself. Taylor Swift's songs are about more than just romantic relationships, but that's obviously a major theme, and her discography reflects the shifts that so many of us go through as we grow up. When we are younger, we often think quite simplistically about romance and heartbreak, and even the way we can make ourselves acceptable and worthy of being chosen, before we're able to see past the fairy tales, see past the heteronormative rom-com representations we're exposed to. The protagonists of Swift's early work are often fairly passive, with things happening to them. They are left, they are proposed to, they are romanced, whatever that may be. The defiance that comes from a song like We Are Never Getting Back Together represent a taking back of that power, that agency that she seemed to lack in early years. And as we unfortunately know a lot of the details of the reality of these stories, this is a very powerful shift in a narrative. Now, to be honest, I'm not actually a huge fan of mapping out her songs to the real things that were happening to her. The whole looking for clues as to what they're about and putting together the pieces and projecting those onto her real life. I know she plays into that a little bit, but I also think her work should stand on its own and mean what it means without attaching to the real story. So I have no intention of breaking down her songs and making a string on a pinboard sort of connections here, but I do want to talk about the John Mayer thing, though, because I think it exemplifies what I'm talking about in terms of the growth. Swift and Mayer were in a relationship between 2009 and 2010. She was 19 and he was 32. There are two songs that appear to be pretty explicitly about their time together. Dear John from the album Speak Now and Would Have, Could Have, Should Have from Midnights. Both reference her young age. Both express regret and anger towards the situation, but there's a very clear shift in her understanding of what happened in between those two songs released 12 years apart. Dear John talks about it from a very personal perspective, focusing on the hurt that was caused, asking whether 19 was too young to be messed with. Would Have, Could Have, Should Have has a lot more anger and the benefit of hindsight of decisions not made. It both takes back some of her agency of the situation, as well as explicitly calling out the predatory nature of their relationship. At a time where Western society is really starting to shift in our understanding of consent and power dynamics, this song is both a very adult response to something she couldn't really see clearly at the time, as well as a call out to other young women who might find themselves in a similar dynamic. The line, "Give me back my girlhood, it was mine first," is searing. So, not only have we seen her evolve as a person and grow up, we've also seen that process through her songwriting and her work. Many of her tracks are about looking back on her childhood or have a real nostalgic feel to it, like Never Grow Up. Also, with the re-recordings of her earlier work, it's been interesting to hear an adult Swift and how that sounds singing the songs of her youth. It's quite interesting and sometimes feels strange knowing those aren't the songs she would write anymore. It alters the meaning behind them in a way that would vary from person to person and depending on their interpretation. Additionally, her re-records give her the chance to make changes to things that she's learned from, most notably in the song Better Than Revenge, a song raging about another woman who stole her boyfriend. Remember what I said about these early songs putting Taylor as quite a passive part of the stories? That's the kind of thing I mean. Anyway, in the original lyric, she says she's better known for the things that she does on the mattress, and in the new Taylor's version, it's changed to he was a moth to the flame, she was holding the matches, since she has learned that, hey, slut-shaming other women isn't cool. So that's kind of my first point. I could dive even deeper and talk about that more, but we'd be here forever. The overall takeaway is that by looking at the way her persona and work has changed, we can see a really interesting representation of a young girl becoming a woman. Which brings me to my second point. Why her appeal is so strong among young women. For women who are about her age, like I am, there's this weird kind of connection we have, feeling like we've grown up alongside her. Her journey in songwriting and growth we've heard in her work is often felt reflected in our own lives, which means that attachment can be quite emotional. The giddy romance of Fearless was something I listened to constantly in the year I got married. Meanwhile, Midnights came out the year of my divorce. It's also not an outrageous thing to say that she's kind of soundtracked my adult life, and I know I'm not the only person who feels this way. But then we get to her popularity amongst current teenagers, some of whom were not even alive when she first rose to fame. They get the benefit of connecting and relating to the stuff she wrote when she was their age, while also looking ahead to her adult work, which provides a sort of blueprint of what they can become. They can draw inspiration from her calling out her abusers, from finding peace and love after years of doubting herself, and learn lessons from what she's already been through. And they can draw power from that. And then we have what draws us all together. I mentioned in the opening that the thing I was most struck by was the seemingly unfiltered emotion in Swift's songwriting. There is no shame in wearing your heart on your sleeve. It's just all out there. As women, we're often taught to feel shame for our feelings. It's too much, we're overreacting, we're overwhelming. And Swift's work gives us permission to just feel. She makes it feel powerful to fall apart, to not deny ourselves that catharsis, and to not invalidate how we feel for the sake of someone else's convenience or discomfort. That genuinely feels like a radical, defiant thing. And when we all experience that together, you get this sense of community. As I said, everyone I know who went to the Eras Tour concert commented on the vibe that surrounded them, this positive, loving, welcoming atmosphere. When I went to the screening of the Eras Tour movie, my best friend and I got in on the action of making friendship bracelets, not sure if other people would get involved. And while we were eating dinner beforehand, these two preteen girls shyly approached us, asking us if we were willing to swap. It was an incredibly wholesome and lovely moment created by our mutual love and sense of being a part of this bigger thing. It also allowed us older folks a chance to reconnect with our childhoods in this really positive way. So that's a lot of the good stuff. The singing along at the top of your lungs, screaming into the pain or the joy or the confusion of what you're going through, the acknowledgement that your emotional experiences are valid and worthy of expression, and the way that allows us to connect with other people around us. But what about the flip side? Everything I've mentioned here can make Taylor Swift's fans feel a real ownership and personal connection to her in a way that can be wonderful, but can also have a bit of a dark side. It can make being critical of her quite a formidable task, as there are people out there who literally do worship her. But she also has her set share of vitriolic hate that is also undeserving. So I'm not going to attempt to go through every criticism or controversy she's been a part of. I'm not here to relitigate gay law or say what I think she should be saying about politics or any of that. But I also just don't want this to be a gush and glorification of her, because I think that is part of the problem. When looking at it all with the framework of growing up and maturing and coming of age, there's a lot to take away that's not entirely positive. When someone becomes so huge in people's minds, they become less of a person and more of a concept, and there is a lot of danger there. The fact is, Taylor Swift means less to her fans as a human and more in what she represents to them, and that is literally different to every single person. Now, before you get defensive, I'm not saying that people don't realize she's a human, but more that the emotional connection people have to her and her work, it's a concept. It's not a tangible relationship. We don't really know her. And when you combine this with a lot of her fan base being so young, it's easy for the emotional component of being a fan of hers to become very intense. You can feel like she understands you, when of course there's no way she actually can. And that leads to the passion with which fans will defend her from criticism to the point of it being problematic. We need to be able to see our heroes as humans and know they're capable of making mistakes and screwing up. And even the fact that what she does is not necessarily 100% authentic all of the time. A good example of this to me is the controversy over the Anti-Heroic music video. That song is about a lot of things, but one of the themes is the public scrutiny over her body. There was a scene in the original video where she stood on a scale and all it said was fat. Body image and eating disorder experts spoke out about this as it was contributing to fat phobia. It was portraying the fact that fat was the worst thing that you could be, which all of the experts in this field know that's really, really harmful. And credit to Swift, she removed that shot from the video. In the days following the edit, the comments were full of people outraged, saying there was nothing wrong with the original. Their argument was that it was how she felt, and it wasn't saying it was anything bad. And even people claiming to be survivors of eating disorders were saying they didn't see the harm. There was an overall inability to step back and see the situation with a broader perspective. Other actions by Swift that have been publicly criticised, such as her use of a private jet, will be met with a similar passionate defence, with an air of how dare you speak ill of someone so wonderful. This is a worry, especially when there is plenty she's done that deserves to be looked at with a critical eye. The release of the song You Need to Calm Down, for example, was seemingly a response to the public questioning Swift's lack of openly vocal support for the LGBTQIA+ community. So now she had a whole anthem, explicitly announcing her allyship and a video featuring famous queer celebrities of the time. But the song was seen in some circles as cynical. While it was praised for being well-intentioned and a bloody catchy pop song, it was also viewed as trivialising the gay rights fight and talking about a complex topic in as simplistic and inoffensive way as possible. It's also worth noting the bigots in the video are depicted as stereotypical rednecks, almost cartoon-like figures. They are dirty and dishevelled and contain all the markers of the uneducated or unhoused. And this may be making a searing point about how those attitudes come across, but they also deny the reality that the real harmful prejudice often comes from middle-class, educated, conservative white people, a huge portion of Taylor Swift's fanbase that she perhaps can't afford to offend. Swift's relationship with the queer community is complex and not something I am qualified to speak on. I said before, I'm not at all interested in diving into the gay law conspiracy, but I do feel like I need to mention it a little bit. There's a community who believe Swift is in the closet and that she's been leaving clues about her homosexuality for them to find. And when she's claimed she's straight, there's been a furor that speaks about betrayal, with some people online even making demands that she come out finally. And this is demonstrative of so many things: the entitlement that fans can feel, the way seeing ourselves in famous people can lead to some ideas getting warped, and how much our subjective interpretation of art can lead us confusing that for an objective truth. Beyond all this, we have her merchandise being hideously expensive, and my subjective opinion, not all that great. We have her releasing multiple versions of the same album, encouraging fans to buy all the things, which not only contribute to her sales, but also to the number in her back pocket. Taylor Swift might be an artist, but she's also a businesswoman, and could some of her moves be seen as taking advantage of a fan base who adores and idolizes her? Or is she just being a hashtag girl boss who is taking what she is owed and has earned? There's no simple answer to that question. A lot of this comes down to Swift being kind of a beacon of white feminism. She is an advocate for women's rights, speaks out about assault, takes back what's hers, but we don't see a lot of intersectionality or engagement with other spheres of influence. White feminism often looks like women taking on roles and places in society usually reserved for men, which is kick-ass, but doesn't do much to challenge or question the patriarchal system that makes her position there unusual in the first place. She is a woman with tight control over her image and persona, perhaps rightfully so, but potentially at the expense of being a more radical role model. She is a capitalist figure, ultimately. In recent months, her love life and headline tours splashing across the front pages have been accused of being a distraction from more serious current world events, such as what is happening in Palestine. Taking the criticism to the other extreme end, we also can't ignore the tendency of our society being dismissive of anything that is largely enjoyed by women, whether it's romance novels or boy bands. Female celebrities are constantly pitted against each other, as though there's only room at the table for one of them, rather than celebrating many women dominating the industry. And the feelings of teenage girls being seen as hysterical or silly, as opposed to young men screaming and crying at the football, which is taken seriously. This shows how we so often view young women and their interests. Taylor Swift is one of the most extreme examples, but there's plenty, from Twilight to One Direction to reality dating shows to shopping. If a young woman happens to show love for these stereotypical feminine things, it's often met or couched with an apology or describing them as, with one of my least favourite phrases, a guilty pleasure. And this is not a recent phenomenon. I've just started my Master's in Women's Studies and I'm doing a subject about media representation. And I'm reading so many articles dating back to the 60s and 70s describing exactly that happening. Women apologising for their interests and dismissing them out of hand. Men's typical interests are seen as more functional or worthy of being taken seriously, while women are called on to say they know it's silly and stupid but they just enjoy rom-coms anyway. This can even be seen in the idea of hysteria, popularised in the 19th century, where women were seen as too emotional and in need of restraint and control. In an article for Teen Mag titled The Invalidation of the Interests of Teenage Girls and Young Women, Bailey Poland was quoted as saying, "When the reality is that teen girls are often very intentional about what they're interested in and aware of the social influences behind those media products, and they deliberately use excitement and passion as the foundation for community building and empathetic development." See, making friendship bracelets to swap with hundreds of strangers at a sold-out concert while you scream lyrics about a heartbreak you may or may not have experienced? That's a pretty special thing in a lot of ways. So, I've barely scratched the surface, really. But the career of Taylor Swift really does have a lot to say to us about growing up, learning from our mistakes, and loving with abandon. And I believe we should view her brand and her persona and her work with a critical eye, but not necessarily a cynical one. We should let people love things, but also not be afraid to see the flaws in things we love. And whether it's Taylor Swift or Edward Cullen or the Die Hard movies or Elvis, we should all have something we love with abandon that makes us feel it's okay to feel. We all need to tap into that inner teenager every once in a while. Thanks for listening, everyone. You'll hear from me again soon.